Hello? Thank you. All right, so I know that many of you have been here many times, and you know the first thing we always say is, please turn off your cell phone or put it on vibrate, so won't disturb anything. The second thing I need to tell you is I guess we're having an event on swine flu on February 1st. So if you're interested, please sign up. It'll probably be a very interesting event. And lastly, as you know, there are books for sale here. Apparently, there's a shortage of books in Hong Kong. So if you do want to buy the book, you probably should buy it here. I know that when I bought it quite a while ago, I had I did buy it. It was quite hard to find. So if you're interested in the talk, if you haven't read it yet, this is a place to buy it. I don't think we make any money on that, so this isn't a commercial announcement. This is just a convenience for you. You know, normally we just start by introducing the author. So I will say that Paul Midler is a consultant who worked in China, and he wrote this book about what is manufactured in China. But just diverging from that just a little bit, how many people in this audience have actually read the book? Okay, quite a few. And how many people here work in manufacturing? So I'll be very curious, if any of you who have read the book and work in manufacturing, did you find Paul's, you know, if you found them true or not true or whatever your comment, I would be very interested in the Q&A if you engage with Paul. I'll tell you my experience with this book is that somehow I got a hold of a copy and I wrote something about it for The Economist. I work for The Economist magazine. And it was accepted by the book review to be the lead article. And then an editor pulled it and he said, well, this can't possibly be true about China. So at the last minute, it seemed like it wasn't going to run. But then we decided, because the editor had his qualms, and I'm not sure the editor had ever been to China, that they brought the Beijing bureau chief in. And he said, oh, yeah, not only is it true, it's even worse than Paul says. So the article was restored to be the lead note in the book review section. But obviously, it's a very provocative issue and a very provocative book. And, you know, to the extent that you can add to what Mr. Midler had to say, it would enliven the conversation. Anyway, with that, let me introduce Paul Midler.
Thanks a lot. That was great. When you read a book with the title Poorly Made in China, you tend to get interesting comments from people that you don't know.
When I went back to the United States after writing the book, I told people that I'd written a book called Poorly Made in China. When I'd meet people wherever, social occasions or in public, and I would get very often these immediate and strange comments, and they were coming to me. As though I were a magnet for them. I would meet somebody and they would say, you know, our family actually had a pet that died and we suspected that it had something to do with the pet food that was coming from China. I met parents who told me stories about how they had gone through their kitchens and cleaned out their entire kitchens of products that were made in China. And these were interesting stories to me because I was reading some things that were in the press, but I was getting a little bit of a different window from speaking to people. Some of the people that I know who are in manufacturing, who are traders or importers, they read the book and they said they'd read the book and that they said that it actually very accurately reflected some of their own experiences. To me, having worked in China, it seemed obvious that China was facing a certain quality challenge. But the problem was that not a lot of people seemed to want to discuss it, to discuss it openly. And there was a great deal of denial or denialism related to the subject. Privately, people were willing to tell me their little stories. Publicly, they were not so open to it. And when they told me their concerns or their experiences, it was almost done in confidence. Is there a problem with China? We look at some of the headlines that we've seen, and most of you are familiar with the headlines. There's been lead in toys, toothpaste, tires, drywall, melamine. These are just some of them. Actually, if you go to the Consumer Product Safety Commission's website, you'll find that there are thousands of recalls, and many of them, a disproportionate number of them, are China-related. Rather than discussing the subject openly, people instead make excuses. They say, well, you know, there are good products and bad products everywhere you go. just as in China, they will tell you that there are good people and bad people everywhere you go. The Guangdong province government in the summer of 2007, when we had the quality crisis, came out to reassure everybody that actually 99% of their products were absolutely fine. It was not a statistic that I found reassuring as a consumer. 99%, how many of you would go out to eat if you thought you had a 1 in 100 chance of getting food poisoning? Or a 1 in 100 chance of getting into a car accident? How many people would step into a car with those sort of odds? In the manufacturing world, 1 out of 100 for many types of products doesn't really cut it. There are also different types of quality problems, and sometimes the issue gets confused because people think that China has quality problems. Well, so does the United States, or name any other country. Other people have quality problems as well. Sometimes when I discuss the subject, I try to distinguish a little bit some of the different types of quality products. You do have random errors, human error or machine, acts of God, things along those lines. You also tend to have things slightly above that, negligence, things that could have been prevented in a production process but weren't because the operators were negligent and they didn't go out of their way to prevent certain things. Beyond that, you have slightly more willful types like corner cutting. Somebody on the factory floor decided that they wanted to earn a little bit more money that month, so rather than putting 120 stitches into a garment, maybe something that put only 100 because they wanted to move more pieces down the line. Even more beyond that, the real willful cases, nothing really highlights the problem more than the melamine case. In this case, you had dairy farmers that were adding water to milk, then they were adding more water to milk, and then the dairy companies, realizing that this was going on, wanted to test, so they were testing for protein. They tested for protein, and then the producers realized that if they added melamine, which is a toxic substance that mimics protein in laboratory tests, that they could actually fool the testing equipment into thinking that there was more protein in the milk. Realizing that they had a nice little game there, they added even more water, I'm sure, and the result was that hundreds of thousands of babies in China were sickened, and a number of them actually died. Now, some of the response to the issue of quality problems in general, people don't like to discuss this issue of whether or not there's a problem in China. They're willing to discuss it if there's an immediate solution. They're willing to admit China has a problem so long as there's a solution, and they try to deliver it just as soon as they're willing to say there's a problem, there must be a solution, and here's the solution. The solution is more laws, more enforcement of the laws. China stepped in realizing that the melamine case was serious, and they executed people. People died because of their involvement in the melamine scandals. You would think that this industry would learn from that lesson. And I don't know what it says about China that the most extreme forms of punishment did not deter people from engaging further in that behavior, but we have a second melamine case. More interestingly, if you catch the news, there's actually another case between the two melamine cases. Some operators realized that there was a byproduct made from leather that they could add to milk that also mimicked protein. That was a small news item. But the second melamine case is disturbing because it's the most extreme form of quality problems. It's willful, people trying to game the system, trying to circumvent third-party testing that's meant to just keep honest people honest. And it's really telling of some of the behaviors in China. This is not a mere case of like something along the lines of food poisoning, or, you know, we do get cases of food poisoning in the United States. E. coli in beef cannot compare with some of the willful acts that have happened in the milk area. At one point, while I'd written an article in 2007 that got some attention, where I described a phenomenon that's also described in the book called quality fade, where manufacturers were diminishing the quality levels over time in a particular production process. Somebody had seen the article at Toys R Us and wanted to have a phone conversation, a conference call. They were having some internal discussions, and somebody who was senior there mentioned that they thought that what was happening in China was a bump in the road. It was nothing different than what was happening in Japan in the 1950s and 1960s, when Japan had at that time a reputation for producing low quality goods. And what I said in that conversation was that yes, quality, you can make a comparison there, but never did we ever have to send thousands of inspectors to Japan to do the job that the factories there either were unwilling or unable to do for themselves. And you have in China today an entire industry has cropped up of third-party inspectors, and they're all over China. They're probably all over Hong Kong as well. They go in and out of China. Some of them live in China. Some of them are flying in and out of China. Type in quality control China, and you will get on Google a number of ads, people spending money to attract customers in that area. Now, in this kind of backdrop with all these quality problems, we had a number of newspaper and magazine articles on the subject. Typically, with a big news cycle, anywhere from 6 to, 18 months later, you expect to see a large number of books come out on the subject. And for whatever reason, this one book stands alone as an attempt to explain some of what was going on in China. As the person responsible for the book, I find it quite odd that when it came time to publish, that I was the only one standing there. While I was writing it, I had a conversation with my literary agent, the guy who brought me the deal, right? And he said, I told him on the phone, I said, you know, I'm really concerned. I'm doing all this hard work, and I can see it happening. I'm going to go ahead and publish this thing. And the work, you know, there's not a lot of money in book publishing. So the work is going to be wasted because there are all these other people that are in the middle of writing books. I'd heard something about some people writing books. And he said, you know, everybody and their mother's writing a book. He said, just don't worry about it. He says the best time to publish a book anyway is when either nobody's writing on the subject or everybody's writing on the subject anyway. So, which is something reassuring, I guess, if you're nervous. And the book is almost a bit of entertainment. I have about 8 projects that I worked in China where I was the go-between. I was working between Chinese companies and U.S. companies, and I selected them in a way that highlighted certain issues and stitched them together in a way that was easy to read. Last month, we had a pretty big surprise. The Economist and another 2 publications, Inc. Magazine and Investopedia, which is owned by Forbes, came out and said, this is one of the best books of 2009. Entertaining, sure. Informative, I'm not going to protest that it's a little bit informative. There are hundreds of thousands of books that are published every year, and in the United States, it's almost 200,000 books alone in the United States. And here's somebody saying that this book is one of the best, and I had a hard time reconciling that. And I mentioned it to a friend. I said, you know, I don't know what's going on here. I really don't know. And he said, well, you know, you have to admit at least that you were at the right place at the right time. And I said, okay, fine. I'll admit I was at the right place at the right time. But there were thousands of others in the right place at the right time. There were so many foreigners in China who saw many of the things that I was seeing. And as Tom suggested, it was even worse than I was describing in the book. The book is no love letter to manufacturers. And not only were there a lot of foreigners in China, but you know there are hundreds of thousands of factories in China, and there are millions of Chinese in China who could have also written this book. This book could have possibly been written by somebody who was local. And what an interesting story that might have made. But you know, people want to be polite, and that's I understand that. People want to be polite. They don't want to point fingers, and they don't want to say, "Well, you folks have a problem. There's a problem in China." The reaction by some publications, Time Magazine, maybe some of you caught the news. Ben Bernanke won Person of the Year, and one of the runners-up was the Chinese factory worker. I saw it, and I kind of scratched my head. And I understand that Chinese factory workers work very hard. The people at McDonald's work very hard. There are a lot of people in this world who work very hard, who work very late hours, and are not thanked often enough or paid often enough. And what I couldn't figure out is if they're the person of the year, the factory worker, where were these people when all of these quality problems were coming up? I mean, where are the instances of whistleblowing? If you were, you know, think dozens of dairy people, companies involved in the melamine case with potentially hundreds of people who knew what was going on, and not one honest soul would come out and say this is going on in the industry, or the lead paint case, or any of these other cases. So that they fell silent on this important issue was, to me, reason enough to doubt their justification for being on that list. I just thought it was a bit silly. And by the way, we're going to wrap up this soon and head more towards Q&A. The cadmium case. There are two cases that very recently have kind of helped us to realize that that there is a problem. Or let's put it this way: there are some people, educated, smart people, who are at this point, based on recent events, just about willing to admit that there may be possibly a problem in China. This is almost 3 years after the crisis of 2007. Just to note that. The cadmium case is one of them. And you had in China the lead paint case for toys. They understood no lead. Now all of a sudden we have the substitution with cadmium. There's this unprecedented level of recall going out in the United States for toys made with cadmium, another toxic heavy metal. The response by Walmart specifically was that these manufacturers did not have standards related to cadmium, and that the United States Consumer Product Safety Commission hasn't been that helpful. They've also sort of said, well, you need to be more clear with the factory regarding certain things. They didn't know that they weren't supposed to put cadmium in there. And my response to something like that is, well, what about other harmful substances? I mean, should we presume that these people know not to use things like arsenic also? Do we really need to have a telephone-sized book that has every possible eventuality of things that you probably shouldn't be doing? Maybe you shouldn't put motor oil in milk or sawdust in rice, or, you know, I don't know. Maybe there's some, do we really need to be that explicit? In business, there must be some level of trust among parties, and there has to be some understanding that people are going to do the right thing. And if we don't have that in place, then what does that say about things like country risk in China, or the possibility that that China's rise is good for us? I don't know. This article that I wrote in 2007, I'm going to mention this and then I'm going to sit down. The article in 2007, I used a historical example, which I'll go ahead and tell you, and then I'll tell you the point behind it. In China, the 18th and 19th centuries, China was the leader for silk products in the world. They were the leading exporter. And competition became intense. A lot of people in China started rushing into the business. Everybody and their mother had a mulberry bush, and they were growing silkworms. Because of intense competition, quality started to falter. It became inconsistent. By 1920, Japan was exporting twice as much silk as China. And the reason why that story is interesting for me is two reasons. One is that it suggests that quality does not necessarily always improve over time. And the other one is that you can't blame the communists. You know, everybody on the China issue wants to say, yes, there's a bad person, and it's communism. Easily solved. And that using Communist Party as a scapegoat, I don't think works. I don't think it really helps to get at some of the issues and what's causing it. I think far more close are the 1800 famines that China suffered since for the last 2,000 years. Far more greater impact on the collective consciousness there than this more recent political event. Anyway, those are just some points I want to lay out. I'm going to sit down and join these two gentlemen, and we can talk about anything you guys would like, from quality control specifics to how this relates to anything you like. That's okay.
So that was terrific. We will take questions. I particularly like the idea that, I don't know if enjoy is the right word, but I was intrigued by the idea of the journalistic and business complicity in the malfeasance that may go on, that we praise where we should be critical, we fail to disclose what's really going on. Can you hear?
No, I don't think it's on.
Hello? Can you hear now?
Closer to the mic.
No, this is not a closer to the mic problem. This is a... Are you sure the sound system, is it good? Can everyone hear now?
Quality jokes.
No, you cannot. We have a problem out there. They still cannot hear.
Is that all right?
Is it okay now? Is it better? All right, they might be, okay. Anyway, I don't want to take away from our speaker. I was saying that I take away, and one of the most interesting things was the complicity of journalists and business in allowing problems to fester. We praise, perhaps, where we should provide insight, and in fact, we buy where we should, maybe we where we shouldn't, or we source where we shouldn't. But far be it for me to take away from the audience here. There was a question, and was that Tom Holland who raised the first?
Thank you. Tom Holland from the South China Morning Post. Paul, you implied that the problems in China are qualitatively different from the quality problems that Japan had 40 years ago, or say Korea had 20 years ago. I would be interested in that case to get an idea of what you think underlies the quality problems in China. I mean, why are they different? What's going on in China that is different from what happened in Japan 40 years ago, say, what happened with the food scandals in Spain?
Right.
And to what extent are the quality problems the fault of buyers? I mean, you mentioned Walmart. To what extent are the quality problems?
Well, those are two separate questions. But let me hit the first one, because before I lose it, you were asking me what the source of some of the problems are. And the book is a basket of issues and kind of hints at certain things. I think that it's very easy to say that much of it's cultural, and here we could talk about China's saving habit or its counterfeit culture and some of how that relates to products. Some of it's also economic in ways that people don't think about. Factories that engage in quality fade or production shenanigans, 10 years ago, if you were going to do something to a big production run and you were going to try to slip one past the importer, your customer, 10 years ago, if you got caught, you got burned. You ended up eating a loss because there was nothing to do with the surplus product in many cases. Depends on the product type. Today, China sits at a crossroads. If something goes wrong with a product and the customers in the United States, they can sell the surplus off to the Middle East, South America without any problem. China itself as a domestic market can be a dumping ground for any number of products. So if I've got a product that I'm trying to sell for a dollar here and I've cut a corner on the quality and I get busted and my cost, let's say it might cost 50 cents. I can still sell the surplus off for 50 cents or a dollar in the domestic market. The company might be mad because there's trademark issues, but if I get caught on that, I could simply say as a manufacturer, what did you expect me to do? You wouldn't accept the goods. I had to do something with them. And that there are many things that went into the decision on whether or not to cut corners on particular orders, and some of it was economic. Some of the origin was cultural as well. And try to roll out a few of those out in the book just to give examples.
I'd like, is there another question?
If I could.
There was a second part, though. Yeah, there was a second part.
To what extent is this the fault of people like Walmart?
That the buyer's to blame. I understand. The buyer's to blame. I think for certain product categories, you no longer have a choice. For certain product categories, you're in the store, and if you want to really look at the country of origin label on every product and make your decision that way, never mind that the country of origin label is really not meant as a buyer's guide. But if you wanted to try to look for things, the country of origin label, you can't do it in some product categories. The analogy I try to liken it to is realizing that you have choice when you listen to the radio, wanting to hear a particular song, moving the dial up and down, and you're not finding the song you want. Yes, you have choice, but you're limited in your choices by distribution. The people who are programming the stations determine what's being played on each station, just as in the store, the importers, and in this book, talking about in terms of how this book is a little bit different, it focuses on the importers in a way that I don't know if any other book has, and these are the people who are really bringing the products over from the East to the West, and even big companies like Walmart and Target, they do use a lot of intermediaries to help round out their sourcing efforts, and they're human people. That's one of the things that I talk about in the book, is that these importers are making economic decisions, but they're also making decisions based on status. You talk to somebody he's been going to Taiwan for a long time and telling all of his neighbors he's been in Taiwan and they think he's in Thailand because they don't know the difference between Thailand and Taiwan. And here he's going to China and now they think he's Marco Polo, or he thinks himself that he's Marco Polo. And he's coming to China and even something so soft like Chinese hospitality can be very welcoming to people. And a lot of the people that I was with who seem to be very hardened, objective, savvy type of business people would just melt under the warmth of Chinese hospitality. And next thing you know, they're doing these deals that when they were back home, didn't seem like such a good idea. By the time they finished their little tour in China, it seemed like a fantastic idea. And then they got home and they say, what did I do? They don't even know what they did. That also weighed in on some of what we'd seen.
Tom, did you? No.
The question I was asking,
yeah,
is that you have a situation where the buyers say, we will only pay so much, and they look at the sample, great, we'll take 100,000 of those. But the price they're offering to pay means they're never going to get anything the quality of that sample.
Well, that's not, you know, I understand that argument that's been used as well. And you go to some of these negotiations and you say, I'd like to buy these, what's the price? And they say 25 cents, you say 20 cents. And you end up settling maybe at 23 cents. You've all agreed on the price. You've all agreed on the quality. And then you find out that you're not getting this. You're getting something else. If you've already agreed to terms and then you get something other than what you've negotiated for, it's not the fault of the person who said, you know, the name of the game in business is to do the best you can. If you're trying to buy, you want to buy for less. If you're selling, you want to try to sell for more. What the factory does in many of these cases that I wrote about in the book also is that they'll say as an excuse, well, for the price you were paying, what did you expect, right? If that's how you determine your morality, you can do that in any case. You can say that for somebody, I mean, let's say you've got somebody caught embezzling funds from the company and he gets caught. And then he says to the company director, he says, well, for what you were paying me, what did you expect? How did you expect I was going to behave? You know, isn't it your fault? You could say this about spouses. Somebody's cheating on their partner. They say, well, for the way you treat me, what did you expect? You can say this in any situation. It's not the way we do things. You agree on things, and then you've got some sort of commitment based on the understanding. And then when people take advantage of that understanding, that's when you have to say, this is not proper behavior.
I now understand why journalists don't do a very good job at get what you pay for. Is that a... let me, you know, okay, Mary, yeah, please. Mary Kissel from the Wall Street Journal.
Tom, Mary Kissel, Wall Street Journal editorial page. What you've just described is based on the sanctity of contracts. It's also based on third parties, watchdogs, like, for example, the media. You know, in the West, when you've got a problem, the brands take a hit, people sell the stock, people get fired. If they had criminal activity, they get prosecuted through the justice system. You know, and you made a comment earlier, and you said, you know, a lot of people tend to blame it on the party. Well, yeah, that's true, not true in all cases. But isn't it also true that the party's creating an environment here which is impeding some of those natural kind of watchdog activities that a market,
right,
rule of law can impose?
Well, one of the things, you know, the one of the phrases I'd used at one point was that, you know, the invisible hand, Adam Smith's invisible hand, doesn't really work when the suppliers are hidden. And these suppliers are really hidden behind, there's really two layers of distribution. You have, talk about retail products for a second. You have a retailer, that retailer is making use of an importer who's not very well known. They're a family outfit, or maybe there's three partners and they've been operating for 10, 20 years, and then they're working with a no-name factory in China. If something goes wrong with the manufacturing process, the retailer says, it was our supplier, we switched suppliers, no problem. One of the things I talk about in the book is private label products. For that reason alone, I don't know if it's such a good idea to use private label products. But it's definitely, you know, also in the manufacturing world, it's important to realize that brands cannot solve all problems. I know in the press we've seen a lot of stuff related to brands. Well, the answer to China's quality woes is more brands. If I'm making a product and I'm contracting with a factory and I say, I want you to make these cups for me, and I'm going to be putting my name on them, I don't want to work with a factory that's also putting their name on a similar product, because then there's a conflict of interest. I'm making cups with my name, they're making cups with their name. In the book, I write a lot about a health and beauty care episode, my efforts to make soap and shampoo in China. And the factory was making stuff in the domestic market, and it was a challenge because we were buying things for 25 cents, and they were able to sell the same thing in China for wholesale $1. And if it was the same product and they had a name on it, there's almost a conflict of interest. But branding's great for increasing margins, and I can understand why some people would want to do that. But for OEM contract manufacturing, it's not necessarily true that you want a factory that has a brand name. There are other things that we could do, though, to increase. You know, if everybody actually knew who those factories were, that would help raise assurances that things were being done properly. I don't know if that's probably,
you know, I just want everyone to come under Mr. Midler's withering gaze. So you mentioned that there is a whole consortium of quality control companies, some which are quite famous and quite international, that are based in Hong Kong and southern China. Why don't those guys go under Mary's rubric and get prosecuted, because they're the ones who are actually certifying, you know, in many cases, the quality of these products?
Yeah, I don't know. The article that I wrote in 2007, I mentioned the Consumer Product Safety Commission.
Or should they? Are they doing a good job? I should be open to that. Are they doing a terrific job, and it's just that people don't use those people?
What I like to say is third-party testing works for reasons that people don't think about. The article that I wrote in 2007, I mentioned a study. I don't remember exactly how many products were examined in this study, but they took a look at electrical products that had been recalled, and they looked at the products and they said, okay, here are all these products that have been recalled. Have they been tested? And like two-thirds of them or whatever it was had already been tested. So testing itself doesn't guarantee anything. But at the same time, you will find that, you know, out of 1,000 products that have been tested, they're more likely to be all right than 1,000 products that have not been tested. There was somebody that did an informal study once. They had they sent out a RFQ or whatever, request for quotation to some factories, and they said, here are the specifications that we're looking for, and the factories quoted. Then they went ahead back to the same factories. They said, oh, and by the way, we're going to be testing with one of these third-party testers. And 6 out of 10 raised their prices by an average of 20% immediately. And there's so testing works for ways that people don't sometimes think. I never would say don't test, but third-party testing is not a panacea. It's got issues. You have to, if you're asking a factory to test a product and they're the ones selecting the product, that's a problem. That's not exactly a blind
test. Did your companies use testers?
We did use testing.
Did you ever sue them if the products were still bad?
I don't know if a bigger issue than that is that you need to know what is being tested. And so you would need to know what you were looking for. The problem with testing is that, you know what I mean? You need to know what you're looking for. And if
this just goes back to the question of what comes under the rule of law. Okay.
Yeah.
Tom, did you have a question that you wanted to... Yeah, okay, great, yeah. Right. Please identify who you are and your name and who you're with.
Ted Kavoris from Panoramic Consulting. Basically, we do investigations in China. And we find that there are a lot of whistleblowers in China, a lot of disgruntled factory employees who report on the factories, and we find quite a lot of them, but the whistleblowing goes for naught because everybody's afraid to take action, or there's no will to take action. For the very same reason that you mentioned, nobody wants to criticize China Incorporated and be seen as preventing economic growth.
Right.
So I just wanted to give you that perspective, that we find a lot of people are quite vindictive or unhappy with their former employers, but
right,
there's no way for them to take action. There's no system and no will to take action.
Well, there's no free press. Where would they go, right?
Well, yeah, even internally. There's
have you ever seen a whistleblower punished for whistleblowing in China?
You mean being assaulted?
Well, no, I mean they confess. I mean, you need to protect whistleblowers. That's part of the...
I'm just saying you don't have the mechanisms in China that you do in the United States. In the United States, if you were to see, and I just picked the United States because I'm American, I understand people here are from other countries as well. In the United States, if you saw something in a production process that you didn't like, you could call the local paper. If the local paper didn't bite, you could call the New York Times. You could call the local TV station. What's that?
Financial.
Yeah,
Times.
The FT.
Thank you.
Well, but anyway, there's more means to report such things. You have better business bureau, trade associations. In China, you don't have those mechanisms. There's nowhere really to go. Yes, people get upset, and very often people are very suspicious of whistleblowers, of protesters. And it's also cultural, and it's also a little bit disturbing that the first reaction that people have to these people is that they're acting out of self-interest. There's a basic presumption over there that anybody who dares damage the face of their company and by extension the country has an agenda, a personal agenda.
That's almost instinctive, though. It's assumed to be instinctive.
It's assumed, and that's unfortunate because, you know, sometimes I like to talk about the all things being equal case. All things being equal, where would you rather manufacture your products? In an environment where there's an opportunity for whistleblowing, or in an environment where there is no opportunity for such activities? And it fails the all things being equal test. It's another problem on top of all these other problems.
Other questions here? Yeah, everyone who has a question, raise your hand so I know how to pack these, and we have about 6 minutes for more questions. So there's
okay.
One
I'll
here.
I'll try to go fast. I'll try to go
one here
yes,
and one
no.
Here. Are there other questions? This table over here is not at any. All right, so we have two questions that we know about. Can we start with that lady in the back? And where was the other one? There was another one. Right, we'll go to you right after her. And Tom, did you? Okay.
Okay, good afternoon. I'm Carola Chad from CNCC Ltd. Having worked in manufacturing on both sides, being a manufacturer's representative where we would go into factories with a cast of hundreds to support and work with the factory as a partner and basically work on our calculations together with the factory, looking at material costs and then building in a reasonable margin for the factory, and then also having worked with importers who would work the other way around and say, right, this is what I need to retail for and this is the maximum I can pay. I would sit with my knowledge and background of costing and pricing in meetings where I said to my buyers, realistically, you will not get the product. You will not get the product that you're asking for because the factory cannot make it at that price.
Well, you know, short answer on that one, if you're dealing with somebody who's engaging in unethical business practices and they're getting 30 cents a unit, they're not suddenly going to act ethically because they're getting 33 cents a unit. And there are a lot of people who think that that makes the difference, that the 10% margin that they're missing is going to solve the problem. And it just doesn't. I mean, if you have people who are really sociopathic in their behaviors, and there are some clear sociopaths in the manufacturing sector because they're the ones delivering, not all of them, but the ones that are delivering the most extreme cases of quality failures, if you're the sort of person who thinks, I would rather save a dollar and I don't care that I'm putting 100 lives at risk, sociopathic behavior, plain and simple. Well, and if you're dealing with somebody of that nature, giving them another 10% is not going to help. It's no different than somebody says, here I've got a guy, he's been embezzling funds from the company, let's give him a raise and see if the problem clears up on its own. It just doesn't work that way. And I understand, I apologize for my tone, but I've heard it so many times, and we're just so short on time, I just want to kind of, and then we move on.
Be encouraged.
I beg to differ. I think in this case, we need to also analyze the sociopathic behavior of some buyers because...
Oh, no doubt about it. No doubt about it.
When a manufacturer is being pushed and cornered like that,
no doubt about it.
By large importers.
The title...
If you don't do this, then
I understand.
You don't get my business.
Right.
They will say yes, and then they find a way to do it. So
the title of this...
You've got to look at both sides,
yes.
I think.
The title of the book could also be called People Behaving Badly in General. There's a lot of that going on and on both sides, and I was very careful to include
sociopathic economies, right? So
yes.
There's and then we have one more question.
Hi, my name is Martin Sabine. I'm an associate member. I studied at Wharton Business School some years before you.
Cheers.
I had experienced some disconnect between, if you like, business school curricula and the real world. I just was interested to know whether you thought anything you learned at business school
Long story short, in the book I did mention that when I was coming out of business school, I wasn't quite prepared for some of the things that I'd seen in manufacturing. I don't think that some of my experience in Taiwan and China outside of manufacturing prepared me for what I was seeing in manufacturing. I think it was its own world, and often actually in the book I do try to talk about how things that I saw in manufacturing didn't jibe with things that I was learning in business school, like economies of scale. I mean, I've never seen in business, you would have in China, people would build an additional capacity expansion with no need whatsoever for the additional capacity expansion. The purpose of the building, the factory, the additional factory, was to attract new customers. And it wasn't what they would teach in business school.
There was a question.
About right. No? Okay. Are we running low
so
on time?
Two more questions? Yeah, okay, so we're going to have from the head to
Robin button. Fox. There were substantial quality issues with the U.S. financial services and banking industries. Yes, and also nobody within the industry spoke up about it, even though they knew what was going on. Have you tried drawing an analogy between the two?
Right, yeah, I've heard people make the analogy, and I just don't know what to say about it. I don't know how the director of Goldman Sachs could be held accountable in a way that somebody who was adding toxic melamine to milk could be held accountable. I just don't know. I don't think that somebody was saying, it's a few bucks in my pocket, a few lives, more or less the same. But maybe the analogy can be made. I know that Paul Krugman made it in one of his pieces in the New York Times, and you know, cheers to him for trying to keep us away from discussing quality problems in China. You know, I mean, that's what I see those kind of arguments as being, a way for us not to discuss this particular issue.
I just thought someone maybe should represent the short-sighted journalists.
Underpaid.
Right.
More, we do a better job.
You know, having been an off-and-on South China correspondent since 2000, I have a slightly different I guess, experienced than you, and I certainly don't deny that there is lead paint in some of the toys and melamine in the milk, and these have led to some unconscionable scandals. But my experience has also been, whether it's visiting Nike's largest supplier or the company that makes Xboxes for Microsoft, or Ericsson's, or the largest mobile phone plant for Ericsson, or riding the world's fastest train in China, that quality does improve over time. And you see some amazing factories that put out amazing products. Now, am I overlooking something as I get whisked through these factories? Or would you allow that, you know, actually the vast majority of China's exports are, in fact, of remarkably high quality?
Well, again, you know, this goes back to the point about the there are good products and bad products everywhere. That issue, yes, I will acknowledge that there are good products over there. I've never said anywhere in the book that all products in China are bad. Part of what was going on in the book is that at the micro level, at the relationship level, where factories were dealing with importers, that what was happening is they were securing deals, and that over time there was a deterioration in what was put on the table. One of the things that the book does is it tries to address why was China catching so many orders from places like the United States. One of the reasons that they were able to catch these orders is that they were able to price the product appropriately. And again, this doesn't apply to things like the high-speed train, because the high-speed train is China making building infrastructure for itself using foreign they're actually importing stuff for things like that. But these relationships, these importer-supplier relationships, you would have these factories that would kind of come in and price things just right. Not too low, not too high, very low, and they would catch the business, and maybe their profit margin was actually zero, and then they would find their profit margin over time by reducing the quality. If you've priced it here, and then you're reducing it over time so that now you have a 10% margin, that's a particular type of strategy that a lot of American companies aren't familiar with. It's not common in a place like the United States for people to do that. And then there are other things in the book. It gets a little bit more complicated. The book does try to address this issue. Why would a factory in China make something for a dollar and sell it for a dollar? Why would they willfully engage in a project where they don't have any profit? And how does it account for the extensive wealth that you see, the signs of wealth, and at the individual level, the factory owners, their successes?
Just as a very quick follow-up, I think a lot of people would be interested. Have there been any consequences for you for criticizing China Inc. in this fashion in terms of visa access or recruiting clients?
Well, check with me after 3 p.m. tomorrow, because I have my applications in right now. but the people have asked, and I've tried to make jokes about it. My most current joke is that I'm not worried about being able to get in. I'm worried about being able to get out. But you can't live your I don't know how everybody here chooses to live their lives, but you can't live your life being afraid of everything. And the sad thing about this book is that it's kind of given me a little bit of a window into the reactions of other people, and it's been interesting. I've had a lot of people who don't have China backgrounds who are seriously worried for me, and people that have China backgrounds, friends of mine, who've burn the bridge with me, who don't want to know who I am anymore because they're afraid that their close association with me somehow might impact their business dealings in China. And I had one friend that was a very close friend that said, that's it. And there's nothing you can do about it. I think if it was between the friendship and the book, I choose the book. I choose five of those friends over, I choose the book over five of those.
So that's a wonderful way to end. We try to get everyone out by two. I mean, we all know if we're in this room that China's amazing. We all know that it has problems. And we all know that it has a hell of a lot of opacity. And so I think it was very brave for Mr. Midler to come here. I really value all the critical comments that were made here as well. You know, the Foreign Correspondents Club isn't a place where the story is written. It's a place where ideas are aired. And I think it was, you know, all the people who raised criticisms or challenges, as the chair of this, I really appreciate that. So through the back of the room, you get a special thanks. Anyway, thank you very much for Paul Midler. We have a gift probably made in China, is it?
Why not?
Yeah, from the Foreign Correspondents Club. And
thank you.
You know, we're delighted you could come and speak.
Thank you.
Books are going to be available over on the side.
There's a lot of one thing.